I'd first ensure that we all have silenced our cell phones. And then I'd ask you to please help me welcome Julie St. John from Huntington Beach as our speaker tonight.
Hi, everybody. I'm Julie St. John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julie.
Thank you, Lee, for asking me and for your hospitality. He and his dear wife came out to our Sunday night meeting a few weeks ago and did a six-hour there and six-hour back turnaround. I don't know how he did that, but I think you make your own hours, right? Anyway, I'm too much of a wuss. I'm staying overnight. I don't care. In fact, I was driving here, and I was telling him it was so beautiful. I was getting resentful at my husband, like, why am I driving alone? Why am I not a passenger? But I'll talk to him later. I'm really, really grateful, and happy AA Founders Day, which, if you're new, is the day that AA was founded by Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob. And I was listening to, it was actually on YouTube. It was a Founders Day AA talk. I thought, oh, God, I didn't realize it was Founders Day when I said I would do this. I hope they're not expecting anything. So I listened to this guy, and he was just, I'm just going to tell my story. So I will give you the stats. I'm 26 years sober, and let's say January, February, March, April, May, June. So almost 26 and a half years sober. I am 60 years old. I am married. I'm a mother, a grandmother. I've worked since I was 15. Not that I'm bitter or anything, but I'm tired, if anything. Looking at toward the, hopefully, the end of my career in a few years. I'm an executive assistant. I have been my whole career. I work for senior executives. I'm currently the assistant, for the last 17 years, to the president and CEO of Mazda Motor Corporation, which is a nice job. Get two free cars every year, and they pay the insurance and that, so that's a nice little perk. But like I said, I'm looking forward to the day that I can not work every day. So I will just tell you my story as I do many times. I always think every time I get asked to speak, well, that's the end of that. I'm glad I'm done with that now. And then I just keep getting asked. So I show up because I know that being sober has given me so many gifts, and I don't know which thing that I do in AA helps me to keep receiving these gifts, but I want to keep them and keep the life that I have. So I just keep doing what is in front of me, you know. I've never taken a break from AA for a few years, or, you know, I mean, I always have a commitment. I go to two or three or four meetings a week, you know, depending on the schedule, but at least two or three. And I'm a GSR and a treasurer, you know, pass a basket at my meetings, because to me that keeps me accountable and coming back and feeling a part of, you know, to do those things. And I sponsor a lot of women and have a meeting at my house and a step study with them. And, you know, it's just become such a lifestyle. You forget that, you know, all these things that are the things that keep you sober. And also, you know, living the steps. I don't just talk about them and do them once and it's over, you know. I'm pretty clear about how to, you know, accept something. I mean, like the current election, all these people are so upset, and I'm just like, you know, I mean, this is non-acceptance if you're not going to just deal. It is what it is, you know. So, anyway, it's what I try to practice. Not always good at it. I'm no saint because I have certain number of years of sobriety and do AA things, you know. I'm definitely not perfect by any means. And I don't even want to pretend to try and be so. It's too exhausting. But so I will tell you about myself and what, you know, as the book says, what it was like, what happened, and what it's been like since I got sober. My parents moved here from South Dakota, a little town in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and that's where they were born. That's where I was born. My mother is the youngest of, or second to the youngest of 9 kids, and so her parents had by that time become alcoholic, and so she went off on her own, got pregnant, you know, as I guess a senior in high school, and then got married, and she had us like, we're like July, August, September, a year apart, my two brothers and I, and then she got divorced. So she was like the black sheep of all her sisters and family. And so she finds my stepdad, and they get married, and they move to California for better opportunities. And because one of her sisters had moved out to California as well. So they landed in this little town called East Los Angeles. I don't know if anybody's ever been to East LA, but we didn't look so out of place for many years, but eventually did. So then they had 2 more kids, and they moved into this little downstairs duplex. There was somebody living upstairs, and that was supposed to be their starter home. And we lived there till I was 16, and then we moved next door. So imagine this little like 2-bedroom duplex or whatever, and you know, I mean, my dad being from the Midwest was a hunter and fisherman, and so he liked to do those things. That was a little odd. Nobody else in the neighborhood was hunting and fishing, I can tell you that. And, you know, it was interesting. I didn't know any different that my dad worked in a machine shop. My mom stayed home. What little money they had, they put us in Catholic school. And so went to Catholic school to 8th grade, and then girls' Catholic high school, and then begged my parents to let me go to public high school because I wanted to be around boys, I guess. And so they did, and it was, you know, I mean, in so many ways, it was such a nice upbringing. You know, my mom was so loving. All the neighborhood kids wanted to be at our house. But there was a lot of weird stuff, too, and I just remember the angst. I had angst. I needed a drink. I am an alcoholic, and I needed a drink, and I worried about everything. Like, they would fight over money and bills, and the lights would get turned off, and then the phone would get turned off. And there was no cell phones back then, so you really noticed it when the phone was turned off and when we were, like, hooking the orange extension cord into the neighbor's electricity, right, before they paid the bill. And, you know, those things, I like to say everybody has a role in their family. I am the second oldest, and I don't know, my role was goody two-shoes and the worry about everything person. I was going to, you know, I mean, I had like an ongoing list in my head of what my life was not going to look like when I got older. And why did I think about that? You know, it's just silly, but it didn't seem to bother my 4 brothers. But I, on this list I had, like, there's going to be no powdered milk in my future. There's going to be no wild animals to eat for dinner. We used to call it mystery meat. And he would, like, come rolling up the street, you know, with dead deer and geese and duck and whatever. And get out, before they had those fancy blenders. So it was like a grinder. You put that in there. If you're old, you remember the grinder, the big steel grinder, and it would come out and freeze it in a like an old milk carton. And, you know, times were hard when the milk carton frozen mystery meat came out. So, you know, I mean, I had in my head that, like, geraniums were poor people flowers. I mean, where did I get that? I don't know, but that was on my list, you know? I mean, because we had geraniums in our inside of our house. But I was just like, I drove myself crazy. I had an ulcer when I was 10 years old from being uptight. You know, what I needed was a drink, you know? But living in that environment, you know, my dad was kind of a periodic, and my brother that's a year older he had joined a gang, this little gang, if you've ever heard of the East LA gangs. There was a gang called the Avenues, and he was in the Avenues, and that was like a lot of low riders. I mean, you just knew in that town to, like, if you walk down to the corner market and you have to walk over Sammy, who's huffing glue, and when somebody in the neighborhood is on vacation, you know where they are. And You know, you just kind of get used to it. I never felt like I was in danger or afraid or anything. I mean, I felt like all my brother's friends protected me. And then my younger brother was like this complete opposite stoner, drug dealer, who eventually started going in and out of jail and then prison, and he was fencing stolen property. And so I felt like all his friends knew I was Joe's sister, and all my brother's friends, my older brother, the gang guys, knew I was Jeff's sister. So I just kind of felt like I was protected. I don't know. It didn't bother me. We prayed before dinner. My mom, you know, all of my brothers played sports, and my mom kept score, and my dad was... And that doesn't sound like an alcoholic family. But I can tell you that, you know, by... I don't even want to say the end of my drinking. That brother that's older was getting in so much trouble. He went in the military, so he, you know, would get... It was that or jail. He had one of those like tempers that... It's just, you never knew. So everybody's on eggshells. Is a beer going to come flying across the room? Or, you know, is he going to punch somebody? You know, it's just, you never knew. And so he got pretty bad. And then he went in the military and started just drinking, because drinking was legal. So he got married and moved off. And my younger brother never really got married. And my mom, who... Growing up, I always wondered why she was up in the middle of the night cleaning the walls up on the refrigerator, and I would just be like, what's happening? Why are you doing this? Until she gave me a couple of these little white pills to help her clean one day, which went on my list of things, because it was fine, except that she would like be up for days and then cry for days. I'm like, oh, here we go again, you know, in her room, and, you know, like wrap presents all Christmas Eve and then cry all Christmas Day. Because nobody, if you knew what was wrong, you wouldn't have to ask, or something ridiculous, you know. So we were always like under that kind of pressure. And so it was just, I don't know. She would like spend my dad's checks, and then he'd get his check garnished, and then they'd fight, and I just, ugh. So Goody Two-Shoes here, you know, keeping my little list going of how watching her and him, and, you know, it's exhausting. And I remember this doctor saying, like, what's wrong? What are you worried about? And I was like, I don't know, everything, nothing, none of your business, you know? And there wasn't anybody else in the neighborhood who didn't have the same thing. There would be more kids in their house in a two-bedroom, you know? So we just got... Get out of my childhood now. You know, I swore that I wasn't going to get in trouble like my brothers. I knew, you know, I thought the knowledge of what was going on, because I knew this wouldn't happen to me, because I will know when to say when, right? And, you know, that worked for me for a good long while. I went, you know, I did well in high school, and I went to... got a job for, and this will date me, but some of you may remember, in East Los Angeles, is the corporate offices for Broadway department stores. Anybody remember Broadway? So I worked there for many years, and did some secretarial classes at Pasadena City College, and got married when I was 20, and I was drinking. I would try everything, you know, watching my brothers circle the drain, and my mom, my dad doing his thing, and my younger brother doing his thing, and so the other thing, I just have to tell you one childhood story, and then I'll leave the childhood. But my dad, being this hunter and fisherman, which by the end there, he practically lived on his duck blind because my brothers were so crazy and had taken over the house. But, you know, I just remember feeling like my life would have been so much easier if I were Mexican. I wanted to be Mexican, you know, but as time went on, we didn't look like the rest of the neighborhood. And so all four of my brothers eventually ended up marrying Mexicans, so now I kind of feel like we are just by association, right? But so in this neighborhood, imagine my dad. I like to say he had this fascination with camouflage. He used to spray paint everything camouflage. So we were that family in East LA. You know, like he spray painted his fishing boat and parked it on the yard, camouflage. He spray painted his, you know, then he'd have his duck decoys and geese decoys out there. And then he spray painted his Baja Volkswagen without fenders that he had that he parked in the yard, camouflage. So I just remember, like, I hate my life. And he would come rolling up the street, and we're young, with a big dead deer strapped to this camouflage Baja Volkswagen, right? And I would see it coming, and I'd just, like, you know, run to the house and be doing curtain patrol with my ulcer. And, you know, all of the neighborhood kids thought it was the coolest thing ever. But, you know, for me, being this intense person, it didn't bother my brothers, but it sure bothered me. And so he'd hang it up in the yard and cut it. And, you know, maybe that's probably nothing out here, right? East LA, it's something. So, scarred me. Anyway, so I go off on my merry way. I get married when I'm 21, and I marry this big college football star, who kind of hometown hero. He played college and football and come back, and we had this big wedding and big party. I remember doing drinking and doing cocaine in my wedding dress, which something kind of told me, you know, that's just not right. But because I'll know when to say when, you know, I just thought, oh, well, I can try anything once. I just won't, you know, because I'm so smart, won't get addicted to anything. So, you know, here I stand. But so what happened was we started acquiring all the things I thought were supposed to fix me. You know, I was driving a Porsche, and I got a house and had a little pool, and I just thought, well, now I'm supposed to feel better because I have, you know, we never had nice furniture and we bought this house, and I just remember thinking, well, this isn't it. I don't have the right house. This, something's not right. So, married a couple years. There was always parties at our house because my husband was this, like I said, hometown hero guy. And it made for a party atmosphere. I mean, these people would practically help mow the lawn. They just wanted to be around him. So, and I was still working, and then he was working. And, you know, I mean, life was good for a little while. And a couple years into that marriage, I had my first child, my daughter Joanna, and I just thought, oh, my God, this is what is making me feel better. This is what I was put on this earth to do, to be a mother. You know, I mean, this, finally, I can see it. And I'm going to give her everything I never had, you know. And she's like, okay, yeah. So I have this baby, and, you know, 3 years later, I had my son Jordan, and things were starting to fall apart. You know, wine after work every day, and these parties were like all weekend, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I had my son, my daughter and my son, 8 and 9 pound kids, and it was after he was born that I just kind of let loose. And, you know, the drinking was every night, and it was maintenance, and I was trying to keep all these balls in the air of working and, you know, childcare and kids and this house and all these people, and it just got away from me. And I find myself a couple years, or maybe a year after Jordan was born, I find myself pregnant with my third child. It was just the early 80s, now mid-80s, 86 is when he was born, my third son, or my third child. And there was a lot of cocaine going around. And, of course, I completely respect Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is part of my story. And I suppose if I knew I was going to be speaking in an AA meeting, I wouldn't have done it. But I liked it. I really liked it a lot. Like, I was looking down, like, at my wedding ring, like, I knew intuitively, this has to be a secret, and there's not enough. I know I need more, because I have a special kind of case where I just need more. And, but I have to keep it a secret, because I'm a goody two-shoes, and I know better, and I'm not going to do that, and oh my God, you're pregnant, for God's sakes. And so I find myself pregnant with this child. I knew better. 1,000 times I knew better. And, I mean, to have that coming out of my pores and just my soul, and I felt so dirty and Like, I know how I feel about people who hurt children, and here I'm, like, killing this baby. I mean, that's how I felt, okay? Dramatic. But back then, it ate away at me. And so I give birth to this. I used almost every day and drank. And I give birth to this little baby that barely weighs 5 pounds. And he had jaundice, and he shook. And I looked at him, and I thought, you did that to him. Look at you. You're a monster. You better not tell anybody that. You better take that to the grave with you. And, you know, to carry that around on your shoulders and in your stomach, and you know, I mean, it just kind of, that's what you look at the world through, you know, those glasses. And so, you know, I was grateful to finally go into the hospital to give birth so I could stop drinking and I could be monitored. And, you know, I mean, of course, they let you out in a day, and I started right back up, and my solution was, well, I've been using cocaine. Well, I'll just try methamphetamine. It's cheaper, and that was my good thinking, you know, my good idea. And so for the next 5 years, you know, I lived that life, and you know, you end up living like an animal is what you end up living like. You know, I mean, we lost the house. The marriage is going down the drain. I just didn't care about anything. I'd gotten fired from one job, and I got another job for another defunct company, Countrywide Mortgage. Like, and then I couldn't get to work because I wasn't sleeping, and I smelled like booze. And then, you know, they'd say, like, we like you, but you got to get here on time. And it's like, this is when they had that 1-800 wake-up service, right? So they set all the phones to that, and I just couldn't do it. So I'd gotten fired from that job. I owed back taxes of like $18,000 because I was claiming 14 dependents. I hadn't filed taxes in like 6 years. I had warrants for my arrest on tickets I hadn't paid. My ulcers are now bleeding. You know, the house goes into foreclosure, and my best thinking was, well, just move my 3 kids into my parents' house. My husband's like, I'm not moving with your crazy family. So he moves in with his brother, who was going through a divorce because he had cheated with his secretary. And so my kids and I move into the one bedroom. Now my other brother is like dealing big time. And so there's just a stream of people, like convict looking people, you know, with alias names in and out all day long. And, you know, I'm like driving my kids to this little Christian school, and we're praying before we go to sleep. And I mean, what a nightmare. I mean, I never want to forget where I go when I have those good ideas. You know, that's where my disease takes me. And that's where I go. So we slept on the floor, and probably for a good couple of years, till I got sober, you know. And the kids are just so loving, you know. I mean, we'd pray before dinner or before bedtime, and they would fight over who got my face, you know. And we'd pray for those less fortunate than us. And, you know, I mean, it was silly, but I would take them to this old Christian school and just try to be the best mother. I mean, I used to say I was a good mother even back then, but, you know, you can't really weigh that out. So I know I love them. I know I did my best through all of that. So that's kind of what it was like, and the buildup, you know. I mean, my mom was, you know, one of my brother's biggest customers by now, and we're robbing him. I mean, it was a nightmare. It was just so crazy. And then to look at us, because like many of us, we're chameleons, you know? I mean, we can dress up the outside, so we think you don't know, but like all of my relatives or people that are in that kind of shape, you know. You just like, whoa, turn away, right? And so I didn't want to be around anybody. My husband and I would go to, hotels for the weekend, and we'd be like, oh, we'll get it all back. We didn't appreciate it when we had it, and it'll be fine. And what happened to get me sober was I got arrested. And you know, a lot of people get arrested, and it's no big deal, but it was my moment of clarity for sure. I just thought, look at you. Like, I couldn't turn the head off by this time, you know? I mean, I was so pickled that, like, it wouldn't even work. You know, the booze wouldn't work. Nothing worked to stop the dialogue, you know? You were going to be different. You thought you were better than these people. Look at you. You're worse than all of them. They didn't, you know, almost kill their kids. And then to, like, look at the family. Like, my mom is this pretty little Swedish lady, and my, you know, my brothers, we could dress it up for the holidays and have nice family get-togethers. Of course, there might be a fight or something, but, you know, we held it together. It wasn't all terrible. And so I get arrested. I try to call my husband, and he was, I told you, he was living with his brother who now had his girlfriend, the secretary, and this woman and my husband decided they liked each other. We fondly called her Hori Lori back then. So, yeah, I never call her that anymore, except when I speak. So, he and Lori, the blonde biatch, moved down to Orange County with what I said at the time, all the white people, like, forgetting that I'm white, right? I've never even been to Orange County. They call it behind the orange curtain in, you know, in L.A. because it just, I don't know, because it's all Republican or something, I don't know, and all white. So I've never even been down there, and it's only like 50 miles or 45 miles away from Los Angeles. So he and this woman moved in. We're going to move down to Orange County, and I'm just like, I had gotten out of my big jail, 10-hour jail stay, right? And I could not stop crying. I cried. I was just like rolled up in the fetal position, like, I can't do this anymore. This is too hard. This is crazy. I can't. I mean, it was like, you know, a friend of mine, Charlie Carney, he talks about this analogy of like all your issues in life in this big station wagon that you're driving, and you slam on the brakes and everything just comes flying forward. And that's how it felt. Like, I couldn't run away from this mountain of warrants for my arrest and the taxes. I wouldn't even open the mail, you know? I just hadn't even opened it. And sleeping on the floor, and I can't fix it, and I don't know what to do. And so I call him, and he's like, it's over. And then I'm like, wait a minute. I didn't like you when I had you. I'll say when it's over, though. So then I'm all heartbroken, right? It's just like, oh, what else, God, you know? And so that started my journey, you know? I mean, I still had insurance, thank God. And I found, you know, I bravely called. I'd seen those ads in the middle of the night about how to get sober. And so I bravely called AA and admitted that my sister had a problem. And they said, well, your sister should go to AA. And I said, oh, she can't. She has kids. And which was like a bone that I had to pick when I was new. It was like, how come all these guys just get to walk away from their families, and women, we have to find rides and childcare and... Anyway, not that I'm bitter. So I, my mom, I had to leave these kids in the care of my mom and everything that was going on in that house and go get sober. And that was really hard for me. But, you know, they dropped me off like they were dropping me off the end of a plank. And, you know, I walked in and there's room full of people. They were having a meeting, and I just thought, ugh, look at these losers. Who are these people? This is like a new level of lameness. Like, what is this, the Twilight Zone? Everybody's smiling and laughing, and, you know, nothing had been really funny for a long time. And so it just seemed freakish. And so, you know, it takes all of 24 hours, and you're thinking, well, if that loser can get it, maybe I can get it, you know? And then another 24 hours, and you're like holding hands, singing Kumbaya, and saying the Lord's Prayer, and on fire with AA. And because I knew that once I got sober, I wasn't going to look back, you know? That's how I felt, you know? Like, this is it. I'm trying this thing now. So, I stay there, and I go into sober living after that, and finally come home, and then my ex, he says, you know, why don't you let me keep the kids till you could save enough and get your job back? And I'm like, okay, but don't do anything shady. And the kids are like, don't make us go, we don't like her. And but I, you know, I had to get him out of this drug house. And so he takes them and, of course, files for divorce and custody and is garnishing, like, my first checks. And, you know, that was my first year. I was the crybaby in the room, just crying, woe is me, probably for the first couple of years. And but there was also something that I would come to these meetings and I didn't think about all the stuff. And I just, you know, it was just everybody. I remember telling someone, I can't ever tell anybody I was arrested. I don't know, I just can't. And they're like, oh, honey, I've been arrested out in the parking lot in sobriety by beating up some girl. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, I mean, I'm with my people. I just felt like, yeah, you guys are my people. You know, you hear this language of the heart. We speak from the heart and the heart listens. And that, I could feel that, you know, when somebody spoke and it was just something really truthful. And so I, you know, start this journey. I had been driving now a 20-year-old Volkswagen, and I forgot to put oil like the week before, so the engine blew. So I really did go till the wheels fell off, you know. And my drug addict, alcoholic brothers and dad, they got together and they pitched in and they put a new engine in my Volkswagen to get me started. And you know, I just didn't have to do anything alone. You know, every little piece, I did community service for those Warrens. I, you know, got a job working as an executive assistant downtown LA for an oil company. And then I just started slowly. I mean, you know, you don't get to fix everything. And I'm so glad because, you know, when I finally got my own little crappy apartment, you know, I'm just like to walk into every room, it's like, this is my room, this is my room, this is my room, you know. And it was just like every little piece of growth felt so good. And you know, I wish I could say another member of my family has gotten and stayed sober, but it's just not the case. That brother that's a year older than me, he died at 45 waiting for a liver transplant, and he had 4 kids, and I'm the godmother to his oldest son. And you know, but it was almost like a peace fell over the family because he caused so much drama, you know, and he was so sick for, you know, the last 5-10 years, and he still kept drinking. He drank in the parking lot at the hospital. And you know, you can't live like that and not have it affect your boys. So of course, you know, I'm surprised they're not more messed up, but not more. They're not messed up. I love them. They're perfect. And but they struggle with drinking. And you know, they've asked me a couple different times. You know, they know that they can come to Aunt Julie, and Aunt Julie's going to help them get sober, which I have several times. And now Josh is like, he's coming up on his year, and I shouldn't bribe him, but I told him there's 100 when he gets to 100 days. When he gets to a year. I can't help it. He's my nephew. So, but yeah, you know, life has been really, really good in sobriety. And these blessings that come just by coming to these, what I felt like, funky-ass meetings, you know, I'm like, what the, you know, and then to have my family, like, you're still going? Why are you still going? You know, and, you know, but the job started getting better. I got asked to interview for a high-level executive, the chairman of the company, of this ARCO Oil and Gas Corporation, and, you know, all because I knew shorthand. I mean, I don't even think they teach shorthand anymore. But, so I started doing that, and then here I am meeting, like, presidents of the United States, working with the FBI and the Secret Service on these presidential visits, and they would come and they would take social securities of everybody that was going to be at the meeting or at the little event, and I'd be thinking, oh, Lord. Because, see, I got arrested. I went out one night with my brother's friends, and I know nobody in beautiful Orchid has ever done anything like this, but we were looking in the back of a Target in the dumpster, and so What did they name me in the rehab? I was the princess in the trash can. That was my they named me. And so I just kept thinking, oh Lord, they're going to find out about me. You know, but what we get to do here in AA, we get to have our records expunged, you know. We get to get our tattoos, some of them, you know, that might prevent us from getting jobs, removed. We get to have others in this program help us find work, you know. And one of my best friends in AA, her husband was the CEO at Dr. Tadoff, and they removed. So I'm like, all right, my husband's a lawyer. Ron, you get the records expunged. You know, John, you get their tattoos removed. Kimberly, you get their... So we're like huddled trying to help them. But, you know, everybody has to... It works when you work it. We're all here to help each other. And so that's kind of been what we've done. Ron has done that for a lot of people in AA. And his sponsor finally told him you have to, like, start charging, you know, like $50 or something. So anyway, so this job, you know, was amazing, getting to fly on private jets and meeting, getting invited to President Reagan's office and meeting President Bush and Senior and President Carter and ambassadors, you know, just because of who I worked for. And, you know, so those things are cool, but the best things about that early sobriety were, you know, my children started to flourish and... you know, he wouldn't give him back, and then he went on disability, so I'm paying him child support and paying for everything for the kids. And, you know, life in early sobriety is not easy. You know, of course, we want, like, a medal for doing what's right, right? Oh, they are your kids. Oh, yeah. But it's hard, you know. We're watching, like, I got married when I was 5 years sober, and you know, I don't do anything easy. I had 3 kids, he had 4 kids, so we thought, and neither of us had any money, so we're like, hey, you want to go on a date? Okay, let's get married. And, you know, well, we dated for 3 years and got married, and so, but we would come here for our entertainment, you know, and, but we're both paying child support up the wazoo and watching our exes buy cars and boats, you know. I remember, and if you're new, you should really make this list, because I made this list. They told us in the rehab, make a list of everything you want, because you're going to get that and everything else. I'm like, oh, okay, is this one of your little activities for the newcomer? Okay, I'll make a list. And I remember that list. I put on that list, I want a new car, and I want someone else to pay for it and the insurance. I don't know why that was important to me, but that was important to me. I want new furniture. I want to maybe quit smoking. I always said I wouldn't smoke, but I've been smoking for a very long time now. And man, talk about cranking it up. Join AA, you know, I was just like a chimney then. And the kids didn't like it, and I didn't like it. And maybe quit smoking, maybe exercise. That was my entire list. And of course, you know, everything and then some. And more miracles, more miraculous things that I could ever imagine, you know. The respect of my children. Ron and I got married when we both had 5 years, and we moved down to Orange County because the judge said, you know, move down to Orange County and you can have your kids back. You know, it took that long for him. I mean, it was a shared custody, but still, you know, they wanted to be with me. But they were doing well, and I was crazy nut job. So in hindsight, of course, it was better. At the time, I never would have admitted to that. Because you know, the big book talks about a lot is wrong, for which a lot has to be done. A lot had to be done to fix my crazy. My crazy was like embedded, you know. I mean, I was like this, you know, and like in Buddhism they call it the drunken monkey mind or the bee in the bottle mind. And that was me. I couldn't stop, you know. I mean, it just took a long time. I was emotional, sad, happy, you know. I mean, it was just like crazy. So probably better that they had that stability, you know, with their dad and me going to meetings 24/7, because I was like, you tell me what to do. I'll do whatever you tell me to do to get out of this pain, you know, and fix this mess I made in my life. And so I did that, you know. It was like 7 meetings and, you know, working and just doing everything you told me to do. None of it was my idea. And, you know, you do the right thing and good things happen. It's just kind of how it works. And good things did happen, you know. My daughter graduated, wrote her essay about her hero. Her mom went on to college. We got her in college, captain of the cheerleaders. And it's made me so proud with her grade point average and how much she loved me. And my son Jordan was a big football player, just like his dad. 6'4", 250. I remember buying his Letterman's jacket. It was like a triple extra large, and I was proud. His neck was like 17 or 18. I mean, he was just, because he was like bodybuilder and a basketball player. And he was just like this lovable giant that loved his mom, you know. I mean, he would come up behind me and bear hug me, and all these coaches were like chasing him around, trying to get him to, you know, give him scholarships to go to their college. And he said to me when he was a senior, "Mom, I just want to stay by you. I want to go local." And I'm like, "Great, we'll go to the JC, Orange Coast, and then you can transfer." So, I mean, we shared a love of music, you know. He introduced me to all his top favorite musicians, and I introduced him to, you know, Santana and Led Zeppelin. I bought him the whole collection, "You Gotta Know This," and all the old good R&B, and he loved it. And you know, when I was 10 years sober, he was a senior, my daughter was in college, and he said, "Mom, this is the football players. We want to go to Lake Havasu for spring break." And, you know, we lived by the school, and they were at our house every day, like all the football players. They'd come there for lunch. And, you know, when you miss out, you just love every little minute. And I tell you, they were like a herd of locusts, those man boys. You know, I mean, they were just so wrestle around like little kids. So he said, "Mom, we're going to go to Lake Havasu." So that morning he was so excited. We went shopping the night before, and he had called my mom, and he went and got some camping stuff from his dad. And, you know, he woke up, he said, "This is the best day of my life, Mom. I love you so much." And he'd said it like 3 times, and I said, "That's so nice, hon. Yeah, I love you too." And I watched him walk out, and I kind of like chased after him and watched him go through the gate, because I thought, I'm so lucky. Like, I don't deserve, you know, to have all of this. And all I wanted was stupid furniture, you know. And he drove off, and he was a passenger. His friend was driving, and there was an accident, and he was killed that day. So that was a buzzkill. And talk about throwing you for a loop. But, you know, I'd done a lot of meditation. My sponsor's very big on it. And since I was 2 years sober, and I thought, I'm not going to take any antidepressants. I'm not going to take the edge off anything. I'm going to walk through this and deal with whatever comes and hopefully be, you know, battered and bruised on the other side of it, but I'll get through it, you know. And I come to these meetings. You guys taught me that. There's a solution to every problem. And I started going to these bereaved parents group meetings called Compassionate Friends. And you hang around any meeting long enough, they make you secretary or speaker getter or, you know, whatever. So they made me chapter leader of this meeting, and talk about a heavy meeting. Everybody's kid is dead, okay? So I said, when I became chapter leader, we're going to change the format of this meeting. We're going to talk about what our child was like and what happened to them and what it's been like since they died. And they just thought that was the best idea. And it was, and I took credit. So it changed everything. Everybody told funny stories about their kids, because, you know, you go out in society, nobody wants you to talk about the dead kid. They get like, "Oh, it's 3 months. You still, okay, well." I read this book, and it had a bunch of sayings, and there was an Indian saying that said, a person dies twice. Once when they leave their bodies, and again, when people stop mentioning their name. So I thought, okay, I can mention his name, you know. And so, like, I set up a scholarship fund for, like, big dumb football players. There was no requirement, you know, just whoever I wanted to give it to. And was their mom, I would always ask if their mom was single. We would do the AIDS walk. We would just do different walks and be Team Jordan. And, you know, my daughter got married. Well, I'll back up and talk about my youngest, Jared, who was born 5 pounds, addicted to alcohol and drugs, and who I could have killed. And, you know, I would flinch when he was young, looking at him, thinking, I can't say that I love him when I almost killed him. So, he has every ism that we have. He's better than, he's less than. If he can't be the star of the show, he's not going to play. You know, he can't be, like, Jordan's big shoes to fill, being this, you know, athlete. And Jared, you know, was more of a slight frame. But I'll tell you, you know, something I should have put on that list. He is now 30 years old. He reminds me when I try to treat him like a baby. But he's married. He got married a year and a half ago. They moved to Florida. He's doing fantastic. And this young man watched his uncle die. He watched his dad become an alcoholic. He watched the ravages on my family and me. And he has never taken a drink of alcohol or had a pill or a drug. All his friends do, which frankly, you know, is kind of weird, but that he doesn't drink. Sometimes I think he should, but you know, because he hasn't, his maturity has blossomed, and it's just so wonderful to be around him. Now let's see, I almost kill him, but all I want is new furniture, and he stays sober because of you guys, his influence in my life. So, you know, I didn't think to put that on my list, but that's certainly one of my biggest blessings. So, and we're very close, but he gave me a run for his money when he was young. Oh my God, that kid. He would play his dad against me and, you know, go over there and not do homework, and then I'd have to clean it up, and tutors, and, you know, because I owed him so much, I was just willing to, like, you know, do somersaults for him. And he knew it, and he knew it. So, you know, I finally put him in this, it's called Outward Bound, if anybody's heard of Outward Bound. It's like they take kids that might be a little bit in trouble, and they take them and they go camping or something, and it's like, you know, teach them responsibility. So I pay like thousands of dollars for this dog sledding, camping in the 20 below whatever snow. And he's so laid back, he comes back and says, they smoke pot there, Mom. I'm like, God damn it. But he's just so laid back, he wasn't, you know, he ended up getting his good enough degree, you know, the GED, and that's okay, you know. I mean, I finally had to stop haranguing him. I thought, you didn't go to college, stop, you know, but you want to be, like, perfect, and everybody else's kids are going to college, and you know, fine. I don't care. You know, he does very well for himself, and he's so smart. Like, you know, he just goes in and takes the real estate test, looks at a book, goes in and takes it and passes it. Never studied for the GED, goes in, takes it, passes it. I mean, so he's a smart kid, you know? Young man, 30-year-old. So that's what happened with him. And my daughter, you know, got married, and she named her first child Jordan after my son so we could say his name. And Jordan's middle name is Juliana, after her grandma. So I didn't put that on my list. You know, my godson, who my brother who passed away, just named his little girl Juliet after me. And, you know, I mean, it's just like these gifts, they just don't stop coming. And all because you show up at meetings and take service commitments and take phone calls from a bunch of crazy AA newcomers like I was, you know. And you're just like, you finally sit down and watch TV, and it's like the phone rings. You're like, ah! And you just want to send it. And you say, hi, oh, yeah, good to hear from you, yeah, yeah. We don't have to do it like perfectly. We just have to do it, you know? And but I set up rules for them. You know, if they got time, I'm like Monday through Friday. If it's an emergency, you call me on the weekends. Because, you know, I see a lot of people. I've seen a lot of people over the past 26 years that, you know, go all in for the rest of their life in AA. And their kids are like, yeah, what happened to our mom or our dad, you know? And I'm not going to do that. I owe them. You know, they missed out. Well, in my early days of sobriety, I had to dedicate myself to AA. But like now, you know, I mean, I played volleyball at Clancy's Yard for, I don't know, 20 years when I was sharing custody and going back and forth. But now, you know, I have grandchildren and they cry when I leave. You know, they want to be around me. And so I dedicate my weekends to them if I can, you know, if I'm not speaking or doing something like that, and tomorrow drive back, and I think there's a 12 noon AA thing, and, you know, I've never gone to college myself, and my sponsor is a doctor, and she just is, like, with a cattle prod all my life, you need to go to college, you know, because I felt it, you know, especially in the environments that I worked in, and so I went back to college, and I ended up being around kids Jordan's age, you know, and they would be like, man, welcome to your car, Miss St. John. You know, I mean, just so sweet. And so I took all these classes, and, you know, the math class, of course, was like speaking Chinese. I'm like, I'm old, I don't understand. And I now know what a polynomial quadratic equation is. Thank you very much. I paid hundreds of dollars to teenage Asians to tutor me. But, you know, I mean, I had to, and I would cry. I'm like, this thing's making me cry. What the hell? And, but, you know, I took my final class. It was a religious studies class, and kids and my granddaughter and my sponsees came and watched me, you know, walk at cap and gown. And in this class that I took, I wrote my final paper on comparing, it was a religious studies class, so comparing Alcoholics Anonymous to Buddhism, and they're very, very similar in nature. I mean, Lee probably knows this. Buddhism is defined by four noble truths. It's not a religion, it's a philosophy that states that all of our problems are of our own making and centered in our minds. I'm like, oh, that sounds familiar. And so these four noble truths are, the first noble truth is life is suffering. And I'm like, okay, I get it. Yeah, I agree. The second noble truth is we suffer due to our attachments. The third noble truth is there's a way to stop suffering. And fourth noble truth basically leads you to what they called their eightfold noble path. And it's right living, right action, right speech, helping others, you know, and just leading a good life. And there's several books written about it. But, you know, that meditation helping me, like sitting with that. There's a Buddhist in West LA, Shinzen, who talks about the formula for suffering. Pain times resistance equals suffering. And I had to sit with that because I had, you know, that pain of Jordan and the divorce and whatever else I conjured up in my head. And so if you have a pain and you just don't want to look at it and you turn away from it and, you know, you grind on it and you can't, and that's growing and growing, and that's the suffering. But if you have the pain and you just sit with it, like a foggy morning, you know, it dissipates. Now it comes back, of course, and you have to keep doing that, but you can't keep hurting. It just goes away. And so all of those little things that you guys taught me, and, you know, that my sponsor insisted, the stupid things that I do that helped me get through the loss of my son, you know, I truly, truly can say, in with several years out since he's died, that his death has given me as many gifts as his life. I don't know how that is. Perspective. He's around me. I could feel him. His football number was 74. His dad's number was 74. Everywhere I go is 74. you know, I stand in line or I get one of those things at the restaurant and I turn it on, it's 74 just the other day. You know, I get asked to speak, they send me the letter, it's 7400 Jordan Avenue. It's just all the time. So I know he's right here or here. Some days he's not around, but I can feel him. You know, the anniversaries kind of bring up, you know, it's kind of a hard time because I still, you know, and I see his friends on Facebook having babies and I just... That kind of, but like his girlfriend, you know, she invited me next Sunday. I have to go to her baby shower, you know. It's just like, oh. But, you know, I got to stop feeling sorry for myself and just be supportive, you know. It's not about me. Of course, it's always about me, right? It's always about you. So, you know, my life is beyond measure. You know, I started riding horses and taking English writing lessons. I almost kill myself because I'm still an adrenaline junkie, you know, getting up on these 6 foot tall horses and going over these jumps. Every day I think I'm going to die. Is this the day? I don't know. I'm going to go flying. And when you're 60, you fall hard. It hurts for a while. It kind of travels up. Everything hurts. So, yeah, we have a great relationship. We laugh every day. You know, I always tell him because he ran for Congress and he's temporary judge and he's very humble and he's partner in his law firm. And I always tease him and say, if you're so smart, how come you don't have any money? But we do pretty good. You know, I mean, now that all the kids are grown and raised and we're not paying for weddings and all of that. But now it's the grandkids and I don't think it's ever going to end. But, you know, to be able to go and speak in Switzerland, like, what? I'm a girl from East LA. How does this happen? You know, I mean, we've gotten to travel. We have this lovely house at the beach. I work for, I told you, for the CEO of Mazda Motor Corporation and president and CEO. I get two brand new cars every year, one for him, one for me, every year. I mean, something like trade them half the year if we want. They pay for the insurance. So see, write your list, newcomers. That was on my list and I got it. But, you know, I just don't know what else to say except that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, it has given me so much. And just for doing these simple, silly things. And I have gotten to grow and learn and, you know, it's a never-ending game, you know, or a never-ending journey on this path of just trying to stay sober and do the right thing. And, you know, some days I just want to say F you to everybody, but, you know, we just act better than we feel. I always say when I retire, if somebody asks me to do anything, I'm going to say, no, do it yourself. It's been my whole career. You know, I've made a career out of making these A-type personalities. Oh, no, you're fine. Oh, you blow up. No, it's fine. I'll get it. You're good. So it's a good life here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have you to thank for my family, for my life, for my relationships, everything you've given me. So... Lee, thank you for asking me. I wasn't really thanking you on that four-hour drive when I was white-knuckling that mountain. I'm like, where am I? Oh, my God. But to be here with all of you, I never regret coming to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and being with my people. So I love you all, and thanks for letting me share.
Another round of applause for Julie.